Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Brody and Marjorie. And if comedians aren't outraging somebody, then they're probably not doing their job. But when stand-up comic Jerry Seinfeld did this straight-up news interview, his apparent self-awareness backfired.
Basic social engagement is really a struggle. I'm very literal. When people talk to me and they use expressions, sometimes I don't know what they're saying. But I don't see it as dysfunctional. I just think of it as an alternate mindset.
Yeah, he also said in there, I think, talking about the same subject, I think on a very drawn out scale, I'm on the spectrum. And he was referring to the autism spectrum. So we're joined now by our, as we are every week, by Art Kaplan from NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's our medical ethicist. Good morning, Art.
Hey, how are you?
So, hey, Art.
So I just mentioned that what he said about being on the autism spectrum, which seemed to have outraged all these families of autistic kids. I wonder what you thought about it, Art.
You know, I have a disability, but I didn't get this as a source of outrage. I find myself thinking that there is absolutely a spectrum. Certainly some parents are thinking, you know, my child with severe autism has nothing to do with the behavioral capacities and successes of a person like Jerry Seinfeld. But we do know that it's a disorder that has sort of mild or almost trivial symptoms in some people, and then all the way over to people who basically can't function and have to be institutionalized. So I think some of the parents thought he's a bad spokesperson because people will start to think, how bad is this condition? But it's certainly the case that, you know, I know plenty of people who say, I work with someone who's kind of, it used to be called Asperger-ish, although that term is falling into disrepute now, and they meant at the mild end of the autism spectrum. So I think, you know, you can identify and talk about your issues and problems without having to deal with a backlash.
Yeah, I'm so glad you said this because I thought it was unfair to Seinfeld because you're absolutely right. There is a wide, wide range from people that – from some of these people with autism that are really unable to talk and unable to, you know, take care of themselves and shower, et cetera, and some people that are a little bit off.
Well, can I come down on both sides of this issue? I mean, if I
– I've trained you to be a real ethicist. There you go.
I mean, on one hand, intent matters, and this was not an attempt and there was no intent on the part of Seinfeld to ridicule anybody. If anything, it was obviously him talking about his own issues. But the flip side is, I'm saying to myself, and I know Marjorie has these experiences too, and you surely do, I try to put myself, which is impossible, in the place of a parent who's got an autistic kid. And I sort of get, intellectually, I'm totally with you, Art, but emotionally, I do understand when they're struggling for funding, they're struggling for understanding, they're dealing with all the 24/7 travails that are attendant to being the parent of a severely autistic kid. I mean, you get that too, obviously, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, we have a lot of diseases that are on that spectrum, everything from the flu, which some people just get a mild version of and some people die of, all the way over to, you know, I have mild arthritis versus I'm crippled and I can't even move my hands or go anywhere. So it is a problem in terms of range, but that isn't to deny the range.
You know, it's also, I mean, humor, it's even though it was a straight interview, the first thing I thought of, which may not be perfectly parallel, do you remember when Barack Obama was with Jay Leno? So, I think it was early 2009, and he had just bowled like a score of like 100. And for those who are not bowlers, 100 or 100, whatever, 120 is really bad. And he said something like, it was like he was bowling in the Special Olympics or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was
yeah.
a big uproar. He ultimately had to call Tim Shriver, who I think at the time, maybe even now, is head of the Special Olympics,
yeah.
and apologize, invite some Special Olympians to the White House. And that's another one where I saw both sides. I understand some people might have felt ridiculed, but he was making fun of himself. He was not trying to hurt anybody, even though he may end up having done so. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Look, I'll say this. If you have Jerry Seinfeld on your side in the autism
That's a good point.
Community, boy, you are going to do well. I think what the families of those with severely autistic children might want to do is say, look, he's putting forward a face of autism that is far from typical and in some ways blurs, you know, the challenges that we have with a severely autistic child. On the other hand, if he's willing to come into your camp, help you fundraise, speak up about the issue, boy, would he be a valuable asset.
Yeah,
well, you know, I'm thinking we had her in here, Temple Grandin, the woman
that
says she's autistic and she's a big animal rights crusader. And you talk to her and you think, wow, that is not what I think of when I think of autism. And she's proclaimed herself to be on.
Well, I don't think she just proclaimed herself. I think that is her diagnosis.
Exactly.
But that's the spectrum issue that Rar was talking about.
Some people might say, well, I don't want her to say she has autism because that's not what I'm dealing with a child that is really dramatically impaired. So I don't know. I can see both sides.
Well, I'll risk getting myself in trouble here, but I'll make this wisecrack. I'm sitting in a building, the medical ethics division works with biostatistics, epidemiology. They're our neighbors. I am surrounded by people poor at social cueing, very mathematically oriented, and I would say probably without naming names, slightly autistic. So that's the skill sets. They bring a lot to the table. They can do things I certainly can't do. But in social circumstances, maybe not so great, very literal, da-da-da-da. So, you know, again, I don't think the way to sort of push the disease needs, services, money, fundraising forward is to rule out the mildly affected. It's to sort of say, you know, lucky for them, they only have a mild version. They're very functional. They're very good at some things. But there's this other huge group, and they have a lot of trouble, and we ought to help them. And since we understand a little about what that's like, let's help them. You know, we can get in the game like a Jerry Seinfeld.
Okay, so let's go from misspeaking 101 to misspeaking 102.
There we go.
MIT economist John Gruber is on our show actually pretty regularly, not as regularly as you. He got in a hot water, as I think most of America
knows. Well,
he's just
at MIT, so why would he be here, right?
When a number of videos surfaced this week with him talking about the Affordable Care Act, of which he is one of the chief architects, you're going to hear a couple of things he said. Then you'll hear John on with Emily Rooney, our colleague on Greater Boston, Tuesday night, explaining himself. Please listen.
Lack of transparency is a huge political advantage. And basically, you know, call it the stupidity of the American voter or whatever. But basically, that was really, really critical to getting the thing to pass.
We said, well, that's pretty much the same thing. But why does it matter? We said, you'll see. And they were both in, and that passed. Because the American voter is too stupid to understand the difference.
I think the point I was trying to make, Emily, is that essentially a very sensible way to do this law would have been to literally copy what we did in Massachusetts. There was one important difference. In Massachusetts, we actually gave poor people money and said, here's the money you get to get health insurance. At the federal level, we couldn't classify it as spending. That's too politically unpopular.
So what do you think? Is this hurt Obamacare or not hurt Obamacare?
Well, if I was him, I wouldn't be running for office. that's not the best phraseology to be using out there, people may think, you know, you're not up to understanding this, you know, people just don't get on board, or anybody who would criticize this is stupid. I get all the sort of backroom chattering, but I don't think it's bad for Obamacare or healthcare reform. I think the Affordable Care Act is actually starting to work fairly well. It's much more in jeopardy because of court challenges to key provisions about mandates and taxation kind of things that are being attacked, and states' authority and federal authority to impose it. But nah, I wouldn't say at this point that kind of commentary is going to imperil it.
You know, we asked you a similar question, I don't know, a month or two ago. I can't even remember what caused us to ask this. Well, I know what it was. It was the survey out of Kaiser, I think, saying that while the beginning of the next sign-up period for the Affordable Care Act is November 15th, 89% of the people who are either eligible for sign-up or required to re-sign up or whatever it is, 89% didn't know anything about it. Do stories like the Supreme Court is now considering whether tax subsidies, which would affect roughly two-thirds of the states that don't have state exchanges, so they use the federal exchange, that the tax subsidies may be invalidated, which are really the pathway to affordability for low- and moderate-income people. Does that cause the level of confusion and fear that's going to cause even fewer people to sign up, in your estimation?
Nope. That's a wonky discussion that you, Marjorie, and I have periodically to fill up airtime about court cases and stuff. It could destroy the thing, but it's not what keeps people from signing up, in my view. people are busy. They've got jobs. They're trying to figure out how to get food on the table and whether daycare is going to be around. They got a lot of things to worry about. And signing up here is just not high on their list. So you know what my answer is. Sign them up. If they don't want it, opt out of it. I think asking people to jump into it doesn't make any sense. We can presume they'd want it. It's health insurance. It's a good benefit. So if you don't want it, you got some other route you want to take, then you can check a box. But I think you should get a postcard saying, guess what? The government has signed you up for something. You might want to pay attention to this. And if you don't like it, then say I don't want it.
You know, but I don't think you have a JD degree, do you? You're not a lawyer.
No.
Could the president, not that he's in the mood.
By the way, I don't even like them, but go on.
I am one, and I don't like them.
I know you are.
If putting aside the other executive order problems he's about to have or issues he's about to have, could the president do that by executive order, or would he need legislation to have the default be you're signed up and then you have to sign yourself out? You have to opt out if you want. Could he do that on his own unilaterally?
I think you could actually you could have certainly put it in the provision to say, you know, I mean, Americans love to jump into things. Even with Medicare, when you hit 65, I guess it is, you start to get things saying you got to sign up and you got to pick your plan, you got to jump in. But I just did my health benefits renewal here at NYU, and what it says is it's time to sign up. You've got to sign in. However, if you don't do anything, we're defaulting you to this plan.
Oh, really?
Because nobody here is going to have no health insurance. So that seems to me to have been an option when they put the thing through. On the other hand, it makes people scared because it sounds like, you know,
the hand of big government.
Choice, the hand of big government, the crushing heel of totalitarianism is on my neck. Yeah. So, you know, it's hard. I understand it's hard. Still, you know, people do it all the time, right? I mean, I don't know what they do at your place, but at my place they also say we're doing direct deposit. And if you don't want that, opt out.
Yeah.
With your paycheck, I mean.
I love direct deposit. Yeah. It's a wonderful thing. So, Art Kaplan, let's do our weekly Ebola update. Good news, Craig Spencer, the physician from New York City, the one that got everybody worked up when he went to the bowling alley and went on
Let me add patient at NYU, but go on.
That's right, patient at
well
NYU.
Done.
He's gone home, and the traditional hugs were given out, like, you know, when Obama hugged the nurse that recovered. Now Mayor Bill de Blasio of New York and his wife, they have to hug Spencer. The New York Times did a funny piece about the etiquette of the Ebola patient recovered demanding hugs. But meanwhile, there's all these nurses, tens of thousands of them, staging these protests earlier this week about what they say is insufficient protection for them and other healthcare workers dealing with patients who have Ebola. I wasn't sure what to make of this because, on the one hand, obviously they have a point. On the other hand, they're only going to certain hospitals now. I thought that was the new deal.
Oh, Marjorie, you're right on target. I think the nurses, I love them, but I think they're wrong on this one because you don't really need to have an Ebola safe moon suit at every hospital and nursing home and hospice and home care program. What you need is designated regional hospitals like Bellevue NYU or the Emory place or the place in Nebraska where somebody can be sent safely. So I would say in Boston, you need to train the EMTs, and then you could pick out three or four hospitals around the area where if someone did show up at Logan and had Ebola symptoms, you would send them to, I don't know, making up a name, Mass General or whatever, and they would be trained and they would have the suits. Remember, equipment is only part of the need with Ebola. You got to train and train and train because the biggest risk is taking off the gear because it gets stuff on it.
Right.
And that's how people get infected. So just having gear is risky. Having gear and training is what you want.
Okay, so Art, we're going to turn the tables on you. You posed a quiz question to us about a week ago. I'm going to ask you the exact same question in return. How many cases of Ebola are there currently in the United States of America?
There's going to be one soon.
Tomorrow, right. And as of today, there are none.
None today.
Now, we occasionally see you on CNN. You cannot watch CNN at night without there being a parcel of Ebola stories. And while I'm a big fan of CNN, rarely is the story about what's happening in West Africa. It's usually about the Casey
Correct.
Hickox or whatever it is in the United States. We continue to create a mild level of hysteria where there is no reason for any. Is that a fair statement?
It is. Thank God the election's over because now we don't have to listen to stories
right.
about terrorists bringing Ebola into
Across
kill
the
us.
Border, right, yeah.
Yeah. So that seems to have quieted down, because that was all pretty nonsensical, stupid. And let me explain why. It's not political. It's just, if you wanted to attack the U.S. with Ebola, you can only do it if you're showing severe symptoms and people touch you. So you'd have to be a kind of nutty terrorist to say, I'm going to time this so I get severe symptoms just as I get out of the airport, and then I'm going to run around and make people touch me, but I can barely run around because I'm so sick, so you're going to have Jim and Marjorie and Art come up and touch me to commit my terrorist act. I'd stick with other forms of terrorism. I mean, Ebola is not your method. So, on the other hand, every time I show up on TV, I have a 9-foot image of the Ebola virus behind my head. It looks like a gigantic tapeworm. It looks like something that will get you in the middle of the night. It's pretty freaky. I keep asking him to take the thing down because I don't think it does anything.
Do you really say that to the producers? Good for you.
Yeah, it's like, look at this thing. My God, I'm afraid of it. I'm afraid to sit in front of it. It's just a slide. You know, it's like, whoa. So the problem's still in Africa. Problem always was in Africa.
How bad, you know, can you give us an update?
Liberia,
go ahead, Margaret. I'm sorry.
Liberia president is ending the state of emergency there vis-a-vis Ebola. Is this wise or is this premature?
Well, I don't think he's got a state of emergency anymore. He's still got a big problem. He has enough beds because the U.S. Army troops have built those isolation units.
Yep.
And so he's got a better situation in terms of care. Guinea, most parts of Guinea have quieted down, although a couple of provinces have had some new outbreaks. Mali, a country next door, had one, and they were starting to isolate. Nigeria, Senegal, quiet, stopped it due to just good hygiene and isolation, so that worked fine. The trouble spot, Sierra Leone, that's still the country where things are growing. It has the poorest infrastructure. The epidemic is still moving there. So some bright spots, some positive notes, but still difficulties in the poorest of the poor countries in that Sierra Leone.
Hey, Art, I was almost late for this segment with you today, and Marjorie was totally understanding because I was doing what I do every morning, which is typing in my daily symptoms into Google and seeing what I had. And unfortunately, Marjorie pulled me away before I got to see what the search results were. Number one, everybody does this, correct? And number two,
types in their symptoms every morning?
No, I didn't mean every morning.
Well, Jim is somewhat of a hypochondriac, Art, if you haven't figured that out already.
But I think he's past that. I think he's on the severe end of the hypochondriac spectrum.
Well, thank you for that.
Yes, he is.
Well, I'm guilty as charged. So, one, everybody is doing it. And I guess two and 2A is one, is this a good idea? Not every day, but occasionally. And two, I read something about, is it Belgium or some Western European nation actually has an alert that comes up when you type in your symptoms into Google saying essentially, don't do it, talk to a reliable medical professional or something like that?
Yeah. I forget which country it is, but they were basically saying, you know, don't trust just any old site that's up there to give you back reliable information. And I'll name a name. You've heard me be critical. For example, I have a spot that comes on every morning. I think it's on in Boston. It's definitely on in New York. Dr. Oz comes on and tells you what to do about a particular ailment. And it's usually chew some berries or ingest some kind of yogurt or, I don't know, chant something backwards or something. And I'm sort of like, I don't know. I'm not a big expert on hives, but as far as I know, you know, eating extract of vulture gastric juice is not the answer to this. So you got to be wary of what's out there in the internet. The internet is about as reliable for medical advice as it is for matching you up with a suitable date.
Speaking of that, can I just interrupt you 1 second?
What?
Yeah, they're great, great. Christian Mingle, all the ones are subsets. You know what I saw on CNN the other night? This is true. FarmersOnly.com. Have you seen this?
No, I haven't seen it.
Dating?
Yes. Farmers.
I can't even say anything about it because I'm going to say something insulting about sheep.
Okay, fine. Let's move on. By the way, the greatest scene, since you brought it up, the greatest scene Woody Allen has ever filmed, when we used to be able to compliment Woody Allen and everything you wanted to know about sex, one of the great scenes ever is, what's the name of the great, Gene Wilder is having an affair with a sheep as you recall,
and
the sheep leaves him, and the end of the vignette is Gene Wilder sitting on a curb totally drunk, drinking from a bottle of Woolite. Do you remember that?
I do.
Okay, wait, I interrupted you. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
It's great. But the thing is, with the looking online for your symptoms, so you always wind up with a massive tumor someplace.
No, generally you do.
In your body. And then I get hysterical needlessly, and you wonder if you should call your doctor and tell the doctor that you looked up on MedicalMD or whatever it is that you found.
But are you saying people – I have to say in all seriousness, I find it useful as a starting point. I know it shouldn't be the end point. Are you saying people shouldn't do that at all and just deal with healthcare professionals and forget the internet?
I think it's fine if you have some kind of weird-looking growth and you want to look it up and they show you a picture of a melanoma and say, if it looks like this, you better go see somebody right away. That's okay. But I'm a little bit nervous about the I have a little bit of a fever, and I wonder if I have Ebola. And the site is one that's going to sell you the natural cure to Ebola. And you've never been to West Africa, and you're not a healthcare worker who treats any Ebola patients. And then I'm starting to think, hey, you're looking up information where they're going to try and rip you off. So, you know, you got to be careful. There's useful information on the internet.
Yeah, I think like bronchitis. I find that useful. Yeah. If your kids have a cold and it's going on for a long time, when do you have to worry about bronchitis or pneumonia or something like that?
There can be reminders, you know, it's flu season, get your flu shot. Or people could say, get a shingle shot if you're over 65, it's important to do this. And other symptom things, it's not utterly useless. It's just you got to be really careful because you got to remember. Hey, people are trying to sell you stuff. They want to diagnose you and then sell you the cure.
Is there a least evil? Is there one of the sites that you find to be least unreliable or most reliable?
Not especially. No.
Okay. All right. No. Fine. Okay. So what's on the podcast?
I think you should spend all morning looking at all of them. In your case.
I do. I don't need that advice.
What you need is consensus opinion.
I've done that already. Thank you.
Yeah.
I have one of those things like Orbitz where they compare the diagnoses from all the different sites.
Exactly.
Okay. That's what you should be doing in your podcast. What are you doing on the podcast, Everyday Ethics?
So this week we're doing something kind of really interesting, which is there's a new vaccine out for a disease that most of us haven't heard about, dengue fever. It's a cousin to our good friend Ebola. But to test the vaccine, you're going to have to give it to healthy volunteers. You're going to have to give them a little dengue. Is that ethical to do? So I think it is, but you've really got to watch, obviously, the informed consent. And let me add, if you created a case of full-blown dengue and then the vaccine didn't work, there's no cure. So that's what I mean, saying eyes wide open.
Oh.
Well, we will check that out. Maybe we'll talk about that next week. Art Kaplan, thanks so much. Great to talk to you as always.
Hey, my pleasure.
Thank you, Art Kaplan. Art Kaplan is a medical ethicist. He is with NYU's Langone Medical Center. He also does a wonderful podcast called Everyday Ethics, and he joins us every week. Callie Crossley, she's going to be joining us up next. She's the host of Under the Radar to talk about the important stories of the week, including one that I don't know how important you think it is, but bigger busts becoming big business. We'll talk about that with Callie up next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.